This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the historian Adrian Tinniswood, speaking with us today about the profession of piracy. Your new book, Adrian, tells the story of the 17th century Barbary pirates operating in the Mediterranean Sea as well as on the Atlantic coasts of Africa and Europe. The story has a familiar ring to it, bringing to mind the Somali pirates currently at work in the Indian Ocean and the Gulf of Aden. But if history repeats itself, how do you draw the parallels between two sets of desperate men in small boats holding a world to ransom?
Now, the parallels are there, Lewis, but we've got to be wary about sort of making them too easy, I think. One of the problems in the way that we've looked at the Pirates of Barbary in the past is that they've never quite got the glamour that Captain Blood and Jack Sparrow, Johnny Depp, Pirates of the Caribbean. There are a lot of reasons for that, I think, some of them less palatable than others. The Pirates of the Caribbean were white. They were, by and large, Christian, not very good Christians, but they were Western. The Pirates of Barbary were almost uniformly Muslim. They were black or Arab, and they represented the other. They were always sort of sinister as far as the West was concerned. They were always a lot more frightening than the Pirates of the Caribbean. So we've tended to sort of sheer away from them a little, I think.
Give us the geopolitical framework of the 17th century in the Mediterranean, the extent of the trade and where the Muslims are and what is the Barbary Coast.
Let me start with that last one. The Barbary Coast starts on the sort of top left of Africa, so the Atlantic coast of Morocco. It stretches through into the Straits of Gibraltar and then along that North African coast through all the kind of places which are in the news at the moment, Algiers, Tunis, and the city kingdom of Tripoli, which is modern-day Libya. That 2,000-mile stretch of North African coastline, that's the Barbary Coast. In the 17th century, that area is under the nominal control of the Ottoman Empire. That means it's part of the Darul Islam. It's part of the lands of Islam. And it was always thought by Christians and Muslims that this area was on the front line. This is where the sort of little wars were fought out between Christendom and Islam. And it's no coincidence, I don't think, that a lot of the guys I've been writing about in the 16th, 17th century, they referred to themselves as Mujahideen. They were warriors for God. They talked about being on jihad. They were on sea jihad to push back the encroaching infidel. They were pushing back Christendom.
They're operating out of ports along this whole Barbary Coast and preying on what kind of shipping in the Mediterranean?
They're preying on any kind of Christian shipping they can find. So it's mainly merchant shipping, and most of it is engaged in the Levant trade. That is a hugely lucrative trade between Smyrna, between, in fact, Constantinople, Istanbul. Ironically, you know, we're engaged in trade. The West is in trade with the Ottoman Empire. And a lot of English, French, Dutch, Spanish ships are moving along the Mediterranean to trade with the Greek islands, to trade with Aleppo in Syria, to trade, as I say, with Smyrna and Constantinople. And they're ripe for the picking. They're not treasure ships. They're not like the great Spanish treasure fleets. But then again, the pirates that I've been writing about aren't just after treasure. Sure, they want treasure when they can find it. But they'll take anything. They'll take the ship. They'll take the cargo, even if it's olive oil or currants or whatever, they can sell it. And very importantly, they'll take the crew. Piracy, and in fact the states of Algiers and Tunis and Tripoli, depended on slavery. The economies of these states depended on capturing slaves and ransoming them or selling them on. Something like 1 million Europeans were sold into slavery on the Barbary Coast in the 17th century.
That's an appalling number. I mean, men, women, children, and yep. Sold as what? As domestic servants, as galley slaves? And
all of those things, Lewis. And also, importantly, if they were well-connected, they're held for ransom. So they can, yes, they can be sort of taken on as cheap labour, but also they're encouraged to write home to sort of to London or Bristol in England and to say, look, help, mum and dad, brothers, sisters, you know, send money. I'm trapped here and my owner has set a price on my head and the only way I'm going to get free is if you send money.
What kind of ships were the corsairs using and what size fleets? I mean, is it a single galley or is it several ships? What's the armament?
It's an interesting story. It's an evolving one, Lewis, because in the 16th century, most piracy takes place in galleys, in big rowboats, with maybe a rowing crew of 144. There'd be a fighting crew of another 100 or so. These ships are very fast, they're very effective, but they can't really move out of the Mediterranean. They rely on shock and awe to overcome their prey. So they will sail straight up to their victim. They will often ram their victim, and then they will just charge aboard. There's no, you know, the kind of Errol Flynn notion of galleons sailing by firing broadsides at each other. Don't work when you've got 144 oars, you know, on 72 oars on each side of the ship. You can't do broadsides. These ships are really effective, but they've got a very limited range, because if you're carrying 400 people, you can only go for about 10 days before you've got to hit land and take on supplies and water. Now, that's the norm in the 16th century. In fact, exactly in 1604, the new English king, James I, makes peace with Spain. And because of that, large numbers of English privateers, that is quasi-legal pirates who've been preying on the Spanish, are suddenly told you've got to stop robbing Spanish ships because the Spanish aren't the enemy anymore. And thousands of Englishmen move into the Mediterranean. They want to carry on being privateers come pirates, and they go for sanctuary. They turn Turk in the phrase. They go for sanctuary to Morocco, to Algiers, to Tunis, and indeed to Tripoli. The significance of all this for your question is that they bring with them Northern European navigational techniques. So within 20 years, the pirates of Barbary move from galleys to the big round ships, the big sailing ships of the West. And they're, within 20 years, they're better sailors than the West ever was.
And these renegade Englishmen are working for the Muslims? Do they make a deal with the Bey or the Pasha, who's ever running the town?
Exactly that. I mean, it's kind of socialized crime in Algiers and Tunis. Everybody invests in pirate raids. Everybody from the Pasha, the Dey, even merchants and shopkeepers will put up some money, and they will finance these raids. The significance of the round ships, the significance of Northern European navigational skills being involved, is that suddenly they can go an awful lot further. So, for example, in 1627, a Dutch renegade called Jan Janssen, his Muslim name is Murat Reis. Reis just means captain or head. Murat takes two ships. He sails from Algiers to Iceland, and he kidnaps 400 Icelandic fisherfolk, takes them back to Algiers and sells them.
He then raids Baltimore on the Irish coast. Explain that briefly.
Indeed, yes. The same man, Murat Reis, he takes, about 230 pirates, two ships, and he tries to raid the port of Kinsale on the south coast of Ireland. In fact, he's warned that there's an English naval vessel there, so he moves along to the tiny little village of Baltimore. And one summer night in 1631, he and his 230 Janissaries, soldiers, go ashore. They fire every house they can find, and they kidnap 107 Protestant settlers from the little town of Baltimore, take them back to Algiers, and sell them. Only two of them ever see their homes again.
The pirates are striking terror into the hearts of the British. Explain some of that. I mean, their ballads, their songs, and mothers scare their children.
They're the bogeyman. And paradoxically, it's not even the sort of indigenous North African Arab. The renegade, the English or Dutch or Spanish renegade, every nation had them. They commit the unforgivable crime. I mean, they turn to, they're apostates, and they are, you know, they're the subjects of broadside ballads in the streets of London. You get plays written about them in London. The most notorious, the arch pirate of all the world, the most notorious pirate in the early 17th century was a man called Yusuf Reis. And Yusuf lived in a palace of alabaster and gold in Tunis, surrounded by acolytes. He had a fleet of 22 pirate ships. And Yusuf Reis started out life as a fisherman from the south coast of England called John Ward, who turned Turk, who became a renegade, and is typical of this kind of breed of very frightening, very committed men. The hard thing, though, is to disentangle how much is greed, how much is wickedness, and how much is sort of genuine, you know, sort of ideological drive. That I think, I mean, for all the work I've been doing on this subject, it's very hard to disentangle men's motives sometimes, I think, because often they're both there. You know, you can be a robber one moment, you can be a warrior for God the next, and you can be both the next.
And you're also a venture capitalist.
Indeed, you're a venture capitalist. The capitalist nature of piracy is nowhere near as obvious, I think, as it is perhaps in the Pirates of the Caribbean. I know Peter Leeson's recent work, which you may also know, about the Pirates of the Caribbean are indeed proto-capitalists. The Pirates of Barbary are state-funded. They're, by and large, they're state-funded, most of them.
What steps across the span of the 17th century do the nation-states take, Britain, Spain, Venice, France, take against the corsairs of the Barbary Coast?
In fact, occasionally they do send punitive expeditions into the Mediterranean. The problem is that if England sends a punitive expedition, Holland and Spain and France all think that the English have got an ulterior motive, the same if the Dutch do it or if the Spanish do it. They all think that they're there to try and gain a commercial advantage. But there's also the sheer problem in logistics. Sending a fleet, or a couple of squadrons even, down into the Mediterranean involved an enormous amount of cooperation. I mean, you know, we're not talking about sending an aircraft carrier or something. This involved an operation that lasted months, that needed to establish supply lines, needed to work out where you were going to victual, where you were going to water, needed reinforcements, munitions. It was a really difficult thing to get down from Europe to Barbary. It was hard to do. And then when you did it, quite often, these harbours, I mean, Algiers in particular, was notorious. It was very, very well fortified. You couldn't do much once you got there. What you could do, of course, was you could try and blockade these ports. But that in itself was difficult because you've got these big, big, heavily armed ships. By and large, the Pirates of Barbary were better sailors than we were. And they could just whip in and out and stay close to the coast. They were much better at the game than we were.
Were they ruthless?
That's a good question. And as always, I think yes and no, it depended. Their reputation for cruelty, the Turk. I mean, we didn't, in the 17th century, we were hopeless. We didn't distinguish between nations. Anyone who was a Muslim was a Turk. That's the way it was. Just indeed as the Islamic world characterised all Europeans as Franks, because the southern Spanish and southern French Frankish people were the first who had made contact with Islam. So we were all Franks, they were all Turks. The notion of the Turk was of a cruel, barbarous race, and they're constantly called barbarians. They're constantly called sort of evil, wicked people. There are stories of male rape, stories of being even worse than that, being forced to convert to Islam, being tortured. A lot of these stories weren't true. I'm sure some of them have a grain of truth. By and large, there was relatively little cruelty involved. Most of the cruelty that happened with coastal raiding, there are accounts of pirates that raided on the south coast of England or the south coast of Spain, in fact, and France, being amazingly cruel. Most of the cruelty seemed to have been perpetrated by European renegades rather than the indigenous Arabs themselves. But that said, they relied on the possibility, you know, it's shock and awe. They relied on the intimidating their victims. They didn't want to hurt anybody. They didn't want to sink your ship because your ship was worth something to them. They didn't want to burn your cargo because your cargo was worth something to them. And they didn't want to hurt you because you were worth something to them. You were merchandise.
And the Christian ships also employed galley slaves. Christians employed slaves same way the Arabs did, no?
Absolutely right. And when I say that a million Europeans were sold into slavery in North Africa in the 17th century, at least as many North Africans were sold into slavery in the Italian, French, Spanish coastal city-states of the northern Mediterranean. There are also throwbacks to the Crusaders. I mean, the Knights of Malta, who are harrying Islamic shipping just as the Pirates of Barbary did Christian shipping. I mean, they saw it as their God-given duty to attack Islam. So they would engage in coastal raids against Tunis and Tripoli. They would rob Islamic ships, they would take the crew hostage and they would sort of enslave them. Nobody had the moral high ground here, believe me, nobody.
Does the piracy impinge upon trade that is beginning to go across the Atlantic from Britain to the Americas in the 17th century?
It does have an impact on trade. I mean, obviously it does, but there is one school of thought, and I'd rather think I subscribe to it too, which says that the Venetian Republic went into decline because of piracy. It could not cope with the Pirates of Barbary. Now, when it comes to the Atlantic trade, you do find instances of Barbary pirates operating in the Atlantic. I mean, I know one particular story of a chap who was on his way to Providence, a Puritan settlement off modern-day Nicaragua, and he was 6 days out in the Atlantic. Atlantic when his ship was taken by three Algerian pirate vessels. That's in the middle of the ocean. But I don't think in the 17th century the Atlantic trade was so dramatically affected. And then it's worth us saying, I think, that in the 18th century, the major trading nations, England and France and Holland, reach an accommodation with a lot of the Barbary pirates, which is a polite way of saying they pay tribute. They start to pay them off.
So then your book covers the 17th century. By the end of the 17th century, the violent warring between the pirates and shipowners of Europe stops, and we have bribery instead in the 18th century.
It's on the wane. I mean, the pirates tend to focus on the smaller city-states around the Mediterranean that can't afford anything and can't defend themselves. What you get in terms of the Atlantic trade, I think, one of the intriguing things is that the young America, in fact, even pre-independence America, is trading very heavily into the Mediterranean. At any one time, there are 80 or 100 American merchant ships in the Mediterranean in the 1760s and 1770s. One of the problems they have, of course, is that they trade under British safe conduct passes. Then we get 1776, we get our revolution, your War of Independence, or whichever way round it is, and the British quite naturally tell the Americans that they can't use British safe conduct passes anymore. And so the Americans have to start paying tribute.
And we pay tribute for how long, and how does that end?
The Americans pay tribute for about a good 20 or 30 years, and they pay a considerable amount. I mean, they pay something like, I think, Yusuf Karamanli, the ruler of Tripoli. They paid him something like $500,000 plus annual payments. And it's only when he gets greedy, that's what stops it. He gets greedy just as Jefferson comes to power in 1800. And Jefferson has never felt very easy about the notion of tribute. Plus, you have a navy now in 1800, and you can't afford the kind of sums that the Tripolitans are asking for. So you go to war. And in fact, as you probably know, Liz, Yusuf Karamanli, the ruler of Tripoli, is the very first head of state to declare war on America.
We're talking about what
about
is...
It's 1803 now, I think, 1802, 1803.
And this is modern-day Libya.
Exactly, yes. And it's part of that campaign against Tripoli, against modern-day Libya, that gives the US Marines their official Marine hymn, you know, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. They mount a would-be coup against the ruler of Tripoli, which fails, but it fails courageously. It's a good try.
But we do manage the United States under the Jefferson administration, the early 1800s, puts an end to the career of profitable piracy on the Barbary Coast.
It makes a major contribution. I mean, we shouldn't ignore the roles of either the British Navy, which is stung by criticism from America because America's trying to put a stop to it, and they say, well, and also in 1807, the British Empire outlaws the transatlantic slave trade. That is not slavery, but the trade in slaves. And both abolitionists and anti-abolitionists alike say, how come you care so much about slavery in the southern states or in the Caribbean or whatever when you've got Christians being enslaved on the coast of North Africa? So the British Navy is sort of stung into action there, and they also launch a series of very powerful military incursions into Algiers and Tunis.
Thank you, Adrian Tinnis Wood, for speaking with us today about the Pirates of Barbary. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News. Copyright Bloomberg 2011.